Reconvene the meeting of Marine Resources, following our chairman.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, members of the commission. As they say, all good things must come to an end. And today, for those that don't know, this is Mr. Josephson's last meeting with us. Carl has very capably served as our counsel for a number of years, and now he's going on to a much deserved retirement. So it's bittersweet that I have the honor today of presenting, if you would come up, Mr. Josephson, a small token of appreciation from the Marine Resources Commission. I'd like to read it if I could. Commonwealth of Virginia Marine Resources Commission to Carl Josephson. Be it known that on behalf of the members, employees, and friends of the Commission, we recognize your 10 years of dedicated service as Senior Assistant Attorney General to the Marine Resources Commission. Your outstanding leadership, wise counsel, support, and enduring interest has been an inspiration to all. We wish you the best of continued good health and happiness in your retirement. I'm pleased to confer upon you the Certificate of Distinguished Service given under my hand in the seal of the Marine Resources Commission this 24th day of November in the 234th year of the Commonwealth. Congratulations and good luck.
Anybody hear me? Typically, at one of these functions, a recipient of a great award like this mouths some platitudes about it's been a great honor and privilege to serve with you all, and I'm not going to disappoint, because it really has. I'm especially impressed by the current makeup of the commission and have enjoyed working with all of you over the years. There have been a few in the past, and I think we're all aware of them, who may not have met that standard that I'm talking about right now. I've also enjoyed working with the staff. I found them to be very professional, very helpful, very dedicated to their job. I can't mention everybody, but I will mention those that I have worked with most frequently, starting with yourself and your predecessor, Commissioner Pruitt, Habitat, Bob and Tony, Fisheries, Jack and Rob, Jane and Linda, yourself as head of law enforcement, and Rick and Warner Rose. You've all been very tremendous to work with, supporting me and trying to assist in defending cases against the commission and on behalf of the commission. And I wish you all well, and I thank you very much. And the commissioner said I can go home now.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. At this time, I'd like to modify the agenda just a little bit. I'd like for Jack to give us a report on the crab license buyback program, if you would, Mr. Travelstead.
This is going to be a little bit on the fly, but we pulled some numbers together last night for the advisory committee, and I have a few more for you here today. The crab license buyback is all but complete. The checks are in the mail.
Jack, let me see if anybody's outside that may want to hear this. Morning, or Doug, can you see if anybody's sitting on a chair talking about something other than crab license buyback program?
The checks will be going in the mail very soon. All of the bidders have been notified as to whether their bids were accepted or not. We're getting a tremendous number of phone calls yesterday and today from people wanting to know why their bids weren't accepted, or with tax questions, which we can answer because we're not tax experts. But the program was enormously successful. We were required to advise the National Marine Fisheries Service when we submitted our grant proposal as to how we were going to do this, to identify what we thought would constitute success. And at that point, we said if we could buy about 150 licenses, that we thought that would be good. Well, we have purchased 359 licenses. We've spent all of the money, $6.7 million. We allotted 50% of the monies for the purchase of full-time licenses, or about $3.3 million. And we did end up purchasing 59 full-time crabbing licenses, both crab pot and peeler pot combined. $2 million were allocated for part-time licenses. In fact, many of those were very close to being full-time, but because they didn't meet the threshold we had set, they were in the part-time category. We ended up accepting 131 of those bids. And then we also allowed the folks that we have on the waiting list, and there are about 450 of those people on our licenses on the waiting list, we purchased 169 of those licenses. So they're gone. There's 359 licenses that are no longer a part of this fishery. That's about an 18% reduction in the number of licenses and pots that could participate in the fishery. Now, some of them are active, some of them are inactive, but as you know, our long-term goal in managing this fishery is to reduce the overcapacity, to get pots not only out of the water but out of the fishery so they can't be purchased by someone else. Last year, for instance, you implemented a regulation that reduced the number of pots that everyone could set by 15%. And now the buyback has purchased about 18% more. So we've eliminated about a third of the potential pots in this fishery. And I think that can do nothing but help us in the long term. In terms of the number of pots that are gone, if you add up everyone's potential pots from the purchase, 75,441 crab pots are out of the fishery. I think that's significant. In terms of crab pots, it was a 15.7% reduction. Peeler pots, a 22.2% reduction in both the licenses and the number of pots in the fishery. We received a total of 664 bids, so there were quite a few more bids than available money. In fact, the total bids added up to $30.4 million. So there were some extremely high bids on the order of several hundred thousand dollars. In terms of the successful bidders, on average, we paid $57,000 for a full-time crab pot, $18,500 for a part-time crab pot, and $8,700 for a waitlisted crab pot. The numbers are not very far off, believe it or not, from what we suggested to the National Marine Fisheries Service in the grant proposal as to what we thought we would receive on average on those. So I think that was just luck of the draw, because we had no experience going into this with the buyback program. Now, the range of money paid out was substantial. I mean, we paid as low as $500 for a license and as high as $175,000 for a license, for a full-time license. There was one person who got that amount, and then it drops off pretty substantially from there down to the average. We are not releasing any information related to an individual and what he bid. We think that's protected by the code because it pertains to an individual harvester. But we have, and there was a press release that went out yesterday. There are articles in the papers today that describe some of the numbers that I've provided to you. Again, we think it's been successful. I wish we had more money to do this again, and of course that'll be up to the feds. I'm not anticipating more money coming in, but this was a program that was designed to achieve certain long-term goals of reducing the capacity of the fishery, and I think it's gone a long way to doing that. And be glad to answer any questions that you might have about it.
Questions for Jack? Mr. Fox?
Why was the ALP program a success and the Maryland program was deemed to be a failure?
Well, I'm not sure that the Maryland program was a failure. Initially it was, but They came back with a different approach. And it's hard to compare the two programs because our licensing systems are so different. Maryland's approach was to target the buyback only at latent licenses and only at one type of latent license. There's a license up there that allows individuals to set 50 pots. And apparently they have several thousand of these and they're not being used. And they went with a reverse auction initially and did not get a very good feedback. And then turned around and said, well, we're going to offer any of you that hold that license $2,600 for it. And I think last I heard they had 500 or 600 people who did accept that offer. And I think if you compare what they were willing to pay for a latent 50-pot license to the bids we receive for our latent licenses, they could be as much as 500 pots. They're very comparable. So I think it suggests we were on the right track with our approach, too. We did give the industry plenty of time to think about this. They had 3 months to submit a bid. Although I will tell you, up until about with 2 weeks to go, we only had a couple hundred bids, and I was beginning to get worried. And we sent out a reminder notice, and within 3 days, we were getting 100 bids a day. They really started pouring in and, to the point where we almost got 700.
Other questions? Jack, I do have one question. We hear, as you know, you and I have discussed the complaint that's come up that an individual can go out and sell his license and then maybe purchase another one the next day or so that's been waitlisted and it's gone back to business as usual. Can you address that for me?
Sure.
As far as the grand scheme and goal of what the intent of the program was to begin with and how that interacts with that intended goal?
From day one, from the moment we were made aware that we were going to receive $15 million in federal money, we began to think about a license buyback program. And consistently throughout that process, the goal of the program has been to reduce the number of pots that are available in the population of pots that can be used in the fishery. It was never about buying a person out of the fishery and establishing some regulation that says that person can never re-enter the crab fishery in any form. It was always about purchasing a license and getting it out. And once purchased, that license is never available again. It can't be traded or sold to somebody who's going to use it. It's gone. But under our current regulations and that have been in place for many years, anybody is free to come and go in the fishery if they purchase a license from another individual. And that's still the case. So someone who sold his license under the buyback program, he decides he wants to get back in crabbing and he's successful in negotiating a deal with another fisherman, another crabber, to buy his license, that's fine. He's back in. But we've fixed it so 75,000 pots aren't going to get back in this fishery. Some people, you know, we had a discussion about this last night at the CMAC meeting, and we have achieved long-term goals with this buyback. What I pointed out to the committee was I asked them about whether they were interested in achieving any short-term goals from the license buyback. And you could do that by stopping all transfers of crabbing licenses today or at some point soon. And that would prevent anybody who sold out from the opportunity in the future from getting back in, or anybody else who wants to get in the fishery. And we had a good discussion of that last night, and in the end, the committee felt like the we have a contract with these people who sold, and it was made very clear to them that once their license was sold, it was gone, but they did have an opportunity to re-enter the fishery in the future through license transfers that are in effect in the regulations at the time that they want to do the transfer. And to now come back and say, we're going to stop all transfers, I think would be a sort of a breach of contract. That's the way a number of the committee members felt about it.
And as a point of clarification, I mean, although we do like the idea that we did incur, if you get right down to it, there is going to be some short-term benefits by this program, but during the entire development of the overall plan, the real concern was latent effort resurrecting and coming back when the fishery rebounded, that the latent effort would come and eat up all of the gains that we had made. And that is just as much an important part of the buyback program as the short-term goals that have been achieved. Is that correct?
Exactly. There are about 450 licenses on the waiting list that when the regulated conditions are met, they can immediately come back into the fishery. We've now eliminated 160 some odd of those. They're not going to be coming back into the fishery. Now, if one of those folks wants to get back in the fishery and can find a license that's available for sale, that's fine. He's free to get back in. Now, we do, by regulation, limit transfers to 100 per year, unless you're a family member or incapacitated or upon the death of the licensee, those can be transferred without a limit. But so it's not as if we allow unlimited transfers altogether.
Any follow-up? Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Jack accurately captured the sentiment of last night's committee discussion. There were two motions made in opposite directions, both failed for lack of a second. And so the committee did discuss whether or not to try to immediately add additional constraints to transfers, and there was not a consensus on that question. But I think Jack highlights the fact that in the long-term scheme of the management of this resource, this really is an important step forward in terms of trying to limit the total potential pool of effort and better align that with the available biological yield in the fishery. That's something that we really did not have a handle on before. And so this really, I think, is an important first step towards managing that question. And it appears that from all accounts, as Jack has indicated, the program was successful at significantly reducing the number of potential licenses, both inactive and active.
Okay. Thank you. Further, Dr. McConaughey?
I was going to say that since I started working in Blue Crabs a number of years ago, this latent effort has always been one of the big 800-pound gorilla in the closet waiting to jump out if it ever recovered. So by removing up to a third of that potential, we've really reduced that. And all of the economists over the years have said this fishery has been way overcapitalized, and this is a way to reduce that pot amount. So I think it was a successful operation.
Thank you.
Speaking of economists, we've had phone calls from UVA, University of Maryland, interested in looking at our license buyback program. They want to make a study of it, I guess, and we are willing to share all of the information that we have.
Look forward to the report.
You may see some published papers as a result of it.
Thanks. Further comments, questions? Thank you, Jack. I appreciate it. Next item on the agenda is public comments. That's an opportunity for those of you in the audience to address the commission on matters not on the agenda. Does anyone wish to be heard? Yes, sir. Mr. Jenkins. Good to see you this month, sir.
Good to be back.
Good to have you back.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowman, members of the committee. My concern, mostly here today, is one item particularly is the opening of the oyster season, December 1st, and the Nominee, Yo Comica, Cone, and Reach the Rappahannock. All going to be open. Where I read the plan was open the area, one area, then all the boats would be signed up for that area, could come in, tong it for a while, then drudge it. And this is a bad plan. It causes the rocks are small, the balls are small, the boats can't get on it and oars to properly. They're all over top of each other. October, when they opened the bars in the Rappahannock, a lot of the guys from there, you went there in the small boats and only worked a day or two, and they was pushed off the rocks. They had to come back home. The bigger boats pushed them out. I was sick at the time when Mr. Fox and Dr. Weston had the Arista committee meeting back in September. Didn't make it. But I sent word to those that did to please recommend to open everything at one time so the water could be dispersed over different localities and wouldn't be concentrating so heavily on one rock and interfering with each other. I noticed on that printout where these bars are to be opened, it says before you get to that on the paragraph ahead of it in bold letters that this plan can be changed at any time by discretion of the commission. I would love to see y'all to discuss this today and make a motion to open everything. Nominee, Yo Comica, Cone, and Weeks and Rappahannock, all December the 1st, and let the watermen go where they want. Have marine inspectors there, the boats is working. When they finish working and on the way in, go by the patrol boat, tell them who they're going to sell the oysters to, estimate how many bushels they have on hand. And this is a way of tallying the oysters that's coming up to a particular bar in that area. We've done that back in the Potomac years ago, and it worked very successfully, Commissioner Bowman. I don't understand why we can't do it now. In our area up there, we are very, we never have in this natural spat, James River and the Rappahannock and the York and the other places do have natural spat. We have a good growing area. I showed Mr. Chick and Mr. Fox a while ago some oysters that was seed that was only 6 months old and some that was 18. All of them are mature oysters. The older ones have got a thicker shell. But we need to have oysters in that area for the watermen to work without, and y'all heard me say this before, out traveling all over the state to get to a place and then to have so many boats that they can't work. I think it's a good plan. I can't see why we can't. Every year we go and discuss this and see, we'll come back to the same old, same old. And I appreciate y'all. Support.
Okay.
And interest in there.
See what staff's got to say, and we'll listen.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Jack, you want to address it? You want to ask a question? He's right there.
Come on, sir. We just had a conversation just a few days ago about changing slightly what we had proposed. We have 190 some odd boats signed up.
Not boats, people.
People to work on a number of these rocks. And let me take you back again to the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel Report, because you know one of the primary recommendations of the panel was that we study the effectiveness of these seed transplants and determine whether or not they meet a cost-benefit ratio of at least 1-to-1. And if the recommendation goes further, that if you don't meet that, then you ought to stop doing seed transplants in that area. Well, this year, we're opening these areas, and we've got to position staff at these locations to monitor the harvest, so we get accurate counts.
so we can do these analyses and make the determination. Once that's done, I mean, and let's just suppose we do meet the one-to-one ratio and everything looks good, the methods that we use for management can change. We won't have to open these one or two at a time for monitoring. We can open more areas. But right now, we're not in a mode where we're trying to manage the fishery to sort of maximize the benefits to the fishermen. We're trying to manage it to maximize the science that we get out of it. And once we get that science, then things can change. I was just talking to Doug during the break that we're going to have a lot of data by the end of this season. This spring, we should get the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel back together again to look at all of it and see what it tells us, and then begin to formulate, you know, management strategies that do help the industry. But now you're going to open a couple of areas.
Yeah, because of the amount that we have, we're going to open the Rappahannock and the Potomac trips at the same time, so they can choose which area they want to go to. And it's not as easy. I mean, it seems very easy to manage these things on paper. But when you get into these rivers with the watermen that don't understand the reason for doing it, and you try to, say, open three places at the same time and tell them, when you start this area, you got to stay there until we finish this area, that it's just totally disregard. We tried it that way. They will go back and forth from the two different sites, so you can't figure out which are the catch and which one. The only way we can keep up with it, we did it last year, and we tried to spread everybody out, but it comes back to you have to, one at a time, finish that area, take the data from it, and move to the next area in order to get accurate numbers. I mean, I wish that you could tell them to go where they're going to go and they would stay there, but if a guy on one bar is catching his limit, another guy's only catching two-thirds of the limit, they're going to gravitate to the bar that they caught the limit. And there's no way of stopping it, and then that just screws all the data collection.
Jack, you made a point just a minute ago about the data collection, getting good data, whatever. I empathize, and I know you do too, with the industry, what they're asking. You know, it'll be nice to get the data so that we can accommodate. The bottom line is, we wish we could send them anywhere they wanted to go, and it would be an easy period. That would be really nice.
Absolutely, and we go through this every year on opening everything at the same time, and we try to do that as much as we can. And actually, staff, we wanted to open everything at the same time, but then you come in and you have processors in the meeting at the same time, and they don't want it all open at the same time because they want their what they have to buy spread over the entire season. And there's no way to open at the same time, and it'll last for the entire season. So the reason we stagger from these areas is to make sure that we have Virginia product for Virginia processing plants for all 6 months of the season. And so we're balancing both the harvester as well as the buyer to make sure that everybody gets their needs met.
Not easy task.
Yeah.
Any questions, Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this can be for Jim or Jack. At the last meeting, Dr. Roger Mann addressed the commission and spoke about the prospect of trying to develop biological reference points for some of these management areas. And I wanted to know, is that going to be specific just to one area, or is that going to be for potentially all of our management areas, such that could be incorporated into the management plan in a broad sense? And if so, is that something that, as we come back to the panel in the spring to consider the results of the work you're doing now, we could also incorporate going forward?
Well, that's a long-term goal that we have. I mean, he was speaking specifically of this question in the Great Wicomico. I mean, we're developing that same information for the Rappahannock now with the rotation strategies. I mean, we probably will not have every river done for the meeting in the spring, if we reconvene, but we are having a couple of meetings this winter to look at the data that we have, We're actually getting a GIS system set up so that anybody can go to a map and click on the Nominaw River and the bars in that river, and they'll see what the standing stock is on those rivers right at the year before, and actually see the 10 years, so we'll be able to make more informed decisions as a group. I mean, it's always a situation where I have data, but it's not out there for everybody to see, or Vince has it. We're getting it so that it's a system so everybody can look at the same data, and then you can start setting, once everybody can look at it, you can start setting milestones or objectives that you want to have for each river. So we're moving that way. We may not have every river done for this spring, but we'll definitely have enough of them done so that you'll see how that will be moving that way.
Mr. Schiff,
this panel next spring, is it also going to look into how we can bring more seed up to the tributaries of the Potomac that don't have the spat set that the rest of the rivers in Virginia do?
That's more of a budget issue than a management issue. I mean, we would be doing that now if we had a budget, but it's very unlikely that the way that the funding is going now, of being primarily federal funds, that there will be money allotted for harvest.
Yeah, let me make that real clear. The state general fund available for oyster restoration is approaching zero. The amount of federal dollars appears to be continuing and may, as a result of some of these federal projects, increasing. But the federal agencies responsible for oyster restoration have made it pretty darn clear to us that federal monies will be used only for ecological restoration and the creation of oyster sanctuaries that must be permanently set aside to qualify for the money. And that means we're going to be very limited in what we can do in the way of seed transplants for industry or maintaining harvest areas. This is a big concern of us, and we've expressed it to the federal agencies on many occasions, and it's falling on deaf ears. They just don't seem interested in helping the industry, and they fail to recognize that these management programs are in part successful because you have public support for them. The industry is the biggest part of the public that supports these programs, and that support's going to go away when you start doing nothing but create sanctuaries and don't try to maintain the industry that so you'll have it there when we do get restoration. Big problem.
Further questions? Thank you, Doug.
Could I say another few words in that program? Not to contradict or anything of that. Just a general.
For a couple minutes, that'd be fine.
Yeah.
Want to move along and finish the agenda up. But for a senior statesman, a couple minutes, I think, is warranted.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
My concern is this, is that the public bottom, which was supposed to be set aside for the public is really not able to utilize it now because of the restrictions and under the management plan that they have. Back in the older days, the state had money to move seed from the lower areas that had spat set to the areas for the grow act. The money that's been spent in the last 3 or 4 years would be to the processors that had shells on hand, and all we've been doing is spending $100,000 in somebody's shell bar where they could have sold those shells to Maryland or somewhere else. They going out on the balls. There's so many shells out now that it's really, it's hard to work. And as for hindsight now, because now they tell us they don't have no money for the upcoming. But I do know that the seed that were, if it could be transplanted there, it would grow to a good, marketable harvester. Have someone back down the bag and show them to Jack, Dr. Weston, and Mr. Fox. Those areas that I'm speaking of, the tributaries of Potomac, has been laying there vacant and vital except for a little patch here and a little patch there. for 15 years now. Back when Herbert Sadler was the replenishment officer, it was state policy for to take that money in the spring of the year and move seed over to James River or to Great Wicomico, pay the waterman a dollar and a half bushels that would work for them, put the horses on a run boat, run them up and put them overboard in these places. The watermen benefit for them because they got work and they could catch them again, and the packers got benefit out of it because they could buy the horses and shuck them. Well, we've lost that. So I'm looking forward to the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel because as far as dollar for dollar back, Virginia's never followed that policy. And right now, the way the oysters are living and surviving, it certainly would be beneficial to the economy and to the watermen and to the packers. I would rather see a plan that benefits everybody rather than one particular group, not benefiting no one, as a lot of that vacant bottom is sitting there. Now, it hasn't been any benefit anyone for 15 years. When are we going to get back into managing a program that will benefit everybody? And we got abundance of seed in the Great Wicomico and public bottom. We have another plan back in my head, and I won't mention that now, but I think the waterman, what few is left, is tired of having something theirs taken away from them. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Doug. Anyone else for public comments?